Good morning, everyone. I call this joint meeting of the House and Senate Education Committees to order. It is 8:02 a.m. here on Monday, February 18th. We are in the Betty Davis Committee Room here in the State Capitol Building in beautiful downtown Juneau. I just want to remind folks who are here in the room with us if they could please mute their cell phones. House Education Committee members present today is Co-Chair Representative Story, Co-Chair Representative Hemshute. We are also joined by Representative Dibert, Representative Elam, Representative Schwanke, Representative Underwood, and Representative Eichheit. Senate Education Committee members present today are Senator Keel, Senator Bjorkman, Senator Yunt, myself, Senator Lukey Gale-Tobin. Please let the record reflect we do have a quorum to conduct business. I want to thank Susan from the Juneau LAO for moderating today's meeting, and as always, Mary Gwen from Senate Records for being here with us to document today's meeting. On the agenda today is a presentation from the Executive Director of the Alaska Municipal League, along with invited testifiers from municipal leaders across Alaska. This meeting was scheduled to coincide with the 2026 Winter Legislative Conference of the Alaska Municipal League. I just want to remind folks if they could please keep their comments civil and not to impugn the motives of any of the characters or members of the committees of the Alaska State Legislature. And again, I also want to ensure that folks remember to state their name and their affiliation when they come and join us here on the dais. I want to let the record reflect that at 8:03 a.m. we were joined by Vice Chair President Stevens. The first item on our agenda today is a presentation from Alaska Municipal League Executive Director Nils Andreasen. He has a presentation that has been distributed to members, and also additional copies are available for folks by the door. And of course, it has been uploaded to BASIS, which is available at akleg.gov. Hello, Mr. Andreasen. If you could please identify yourself for the record and begin your presentation when you are ready.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Nils Andreasen. I'm the executive director of the Alaska Municipal League. This is always a larger space to say hello to, but really appreciate the opportunity this morning. We've been before this group in the past, and really appreciate again the fact that this is time to coincide with our winter legislative conference with 100 municipal officials here in Juneau, talking about all the things that you're talking about. I want to talk today about municipal perspective on school funding. Over the years, we've talked pretty extensively about all the different perspectives. I'm going to focus today mostly on facilities, but I do want to make sure that we don't leave everything else out. So local governments are just as interested in achievement within our schools as the legislature and as our school districts. We're interested in educational outcomes. We're interested in testing and attendance. And we're not responsible for any of those. So I think it's worth knowing that local governments are one of the primary funders of Alaska's public education system. And entirely outside of the decision-making role when it comes to student educational attainment, the process for that school boards go through to determine curricula and their own decisions. So local governments, I think, are interested in, are recognize how important those educational outcomes are to their community, to their residents, to families, to businesses within their communities, and are kind of distinctly outside of that process. I also think that one of the conversations we've had over the years within AML is relative to accountability, right? A lot of the conversation outside, or maybe within the legislature and in the media, has been around testing and attendance. We know how challenging attendance can be. And we know that within kind of our current structure of brick and mortar schools, correspondence, you know, all the different types of schools that are out there, there are different approaches to attendance, different outcomes from attendance and testing, and expectations of students that really vary. And many of them all funded by these public education dollars. Those activities are just as important for local governments as they are to you and to school districts. And again, there's no role for local governments in managing that. I think the other thing that local governments are paying attention to when it comes to accountability is how are school districts performing with their financials, right? So as a major funder, but with no decision-making around how budgets are developed or dollars are spent, there's a disconnect for us in the same way that there's kind of a disconnect between the legislature and its allocation of dollars to school districts and school boards who ultimately make decisions on their own and separately. So those are three layers of accountability that local governments are paying attention to and honestly want to see improvements for and happy to engage further in that in the future. Who pays matters a lot to local governments, mostly because in many districts, local governments pay a large portion of school district budget. That's happens through, for municipal school districts, through a required local contribution, as you know. And in many districts, their local governments are providing up to the cap. In some, they're allowed to go beyond the cap. In some districts, local governments provide more than the state of Alaska does to the public education in those regions. So it's who pays matters. One of the arguments we've made, too, over the years is that impact aid is local. And I know this body is two bodies. I talked before about impact aid and the effect of the local contribution and how those two things are tied together. When it comes to impact aid, the reason to think that impact aid is local is because it's meant to replace or offset what would otherwise be taxable within a community. And if it weren't for the current disparity test and how the state counts impact aid as state funding or to offset the state's responsibility, those districts would each have access to dollars that wouldn't otherwise be possible because of that federal tax exemption and the impact of federal workers in their community. So that matters. And I know that we think about the disparity test as correcting for, but actually impact aid and the way it's used right now is contributing to disparity in our communities. And it's easy to kind of think about that in terms of what's available to each district differently for impact aid. So where there's a local contribution, impact aid is the amount of impact aid used as state dollars is less in that community than where there's no local contribution and the entirety of impact aid is used as state dollars.
Mr. Andreessen, we have a question from Senator Keel.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Not a question. I just wanted to remind Mr. Andreessen that no community is allowed to go beyond the cap, but to quote the person, the senator who wrote the cap, some things are not subject to it. So if it doesn't touch the classroom, the cap doesn't cover it.
Sorry.
Thank you.
Thank you for the record. I think when we're thinking about the disparity test, the way that I understand it, and maybe not in reference to the cap, but there are five districts at the top who give more than others, and there are five districts at the bottom who give less. They are tossed out of the formula, and the rest have to fall in line within the bounds that are set by statute. Ultimately, who pays matters, who is able to pay, and for what matters. And local governments are increasingly paying more as the state's share has either stayed the same, diminished over time, or otherwise. So as property tax or property valuation goes up, the full value determination goes up, local governments are contributing more, and ultimately more as a percentage relative to how much the state's contributing as a percentage when that stays flat. Facilities is what I'm going to spend most of my time on today, but you're familiar already with how school construction and major maintenance is funded in the state, or not. School bond debt reimbursement is one of those tools that have been out there. School bond debt reimbursement kind of recognizes that local governments don't have the same tax base that the state has, And where there is a tax base, where there is bonding capacity within a jurisdiction that's responsible for a municipal school district, they're able to bond and receive a reimbursement by the state for a certain percentage, and that percentage has decreased over time as they've increasingly picked up more of that burden. For many years, school bond debt reimbursement has had a moratorium, and that's had certain consequences. School bond debt reimbursement is also tied to some of the funding that has been able to go out to REAAs, regional education attainment areas, attendance areas. So those two things, when school bond debt reimbursement goes down, so does at least the statutory amount that's available for the REAA fund. Those things are tied together. School construction and major maintenance is the other element of funding our facilities in the state, and I'll talk a little bit more about that. But ultimately, when it comes to facilities, the state's under investing in those over time, and we'll see that for the amount of need that's been submitted to the state, on average over the last 15 years, it's been about 10% to 15% that's been funded, and higher in years where the state has more money and less when it doesn't. So that's the kind of broad scope that local governments approach school funding and school districts with. And there's a lot of variety to that, and you'll hear speakers later kind of talking about the nuance and ultimately the value of a good working relationship between a city, a borough, a school district, and the state to get things done in our communities. I will continue. I was playing this weekend with capital planning dashboards. So one of the resources that you've got at your disposal is the Department of Education Facilities Division, who does a lot of good work to identify what facilities needs are out there, to track what's coming back from school districts that are required to submit annually reports on those needs that they have for school construction and major maintenance. This capital planning dashboard comes in a variety of forms, and I will go through a couple of them. This is something like a 10-year plan. It includes the anticipated replacement year for all the system improvements necessary at LEF, so anything from HVAC controls to equipment and furnishings, exterior doors, roof systems, all the needs that might come up for schools that that school districts are responsible to maintain. It's worth noting that many of those schools are actually state schools, that you own many of the schools that are out there, the actual buildings that are there, they're yours. We would argue that the responsibilities to repair, maintain, et cetera, lie with the state. So we're talking about over the next 10 years needing about $6.3 billion. And so I come to you asking today for $6.3 billion. It's worth knowing that that's front-loaded, right? Because you know more today than you do about what will occur in 10 years. So you can see kind of really what ends up being about an averaged amount over the coming years outside of 2026, $250 million, $300 million. That's actually about the average of what's been submitted across six-year plans for the last decade. So it's not surprising to see that number being about what you need to maintain this system of public education. It's front-loaded, $3.7 million or billion needed today. I'm not going to ask for that today, but you need to know, I think that's the need as articulated by school districts. And that's pent-up need, right? That is $300 million on average every year submitted to the legislature for funding and not funded mostly. So what you're seeing in that number is not just the result of deferred maintenance, but it's the result of underinvestment in those school facilities. So that's the big picture number, and one way for the state to be thinking about the funds needed to maintain a system of public education. The capital planning dashboards that the Department of Education Facilities Division provides are fun to play with. Right, and I didn't include all the information in these slides, and it's not well presented. But at the statewide level, they are looking at the gross square footage of those facilities, current ADM, the total insured value, and the estimated construction cost in a variety of ways. And they can kind of split that out, the insured cost versus or per square foot, the gross square footage per ADM. But the total insured value right now, an insured value that's required in statute, I think, $11.6 billion that's necessary. Estimated construction cost of $20 billion. I think that means that if you had to replace all of it today, that's what it would cost. And it would be worth, I think, having the department, you know, come in and talk more about these numbers. I'm outside of this process and honestly looking forward to learning more. I did pull out one district, Alaska Gateway, in this example. So if statewide is the, you see the $11.6 billion total, district-wide for Alaska Gateway, the total insured values, $90 million, and that estimated construction cost, $145 million. And then you can dive deeper by attendance area in each district. So for that district, you can see for every school facility what those total insured values look like, the estimated construction cost, and compare them by student and square footage. And it gets down to additional levels of analysis and what your base cost per square foot is. And you can pull up every district, every school, and you can see what that looks like, and then you can compare and start to build out and maybe model an approach to addressing facilities needs in a variety of ways.
Hold on a second. We have a question from Representative Schwanke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Nils, I just, Mr. Anderson, kind of a question since you pulled out some REAA districts, one of them in particular, obviously my district. Out of curiosity, what do you recommend as a annual maintenance portion of a school budget, any school budget around the state? Because you mentioned earlier that it might not be the school district's responsibility to do maintenance. And so my understanding is that there is an industry threshold that all organizations, business owners, entities should be putting on an annual basis into their maintenance so that we can keep our facilities off the major maintenance list. So if you could expand on that, that would be great.
Representative Schwanke, through the chair, and I didn't mean to call out this one for you, but this just seemed to, it was the first one that I clicked on. I will actually talk about that a little bit later, but I think the industry standard is 2% and then 1% for maintenance. I think we could have a dialogue, and I've been told not to do that in committee meetings, but about whose responsibility it is, and you can in statute require a school district to provide some level of maintenance, right? I think you can also think about it in terms of if we own a school, if this is our school, is it our job? And you can follow it through from constitution to statute to kind of what is the responsibility ultimately of the state in delivering on those obligations. There have been changes, and I'll talk through some of those changes over the years in the department's Department of Education's approach to funding maintenance, especially, including most recently to double the amount necessary to be eligible for major maintenance, which increases the cost to each district for what they're responsible for. But we'll talk more about that. For
quick follow-up.
Yeah.
Follow-up through the chair. Just a rough response. How many districts around the state do you believe are spending enough on an annual basis out of their existing budget for maintenance? Is it appropriate?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Schwanke, I don't know.
Yeah. Thank you.
I also think that's the work in front of us. And one of the reasons to kind of bring, if you haven't had a chance to go through this dashboard, if you have, it's worth kind of digging in and trying to figure that out. and start looking at where are there models that might apply? Are there different rubrics or metrics for determining how much is the right amount, and what is the right amount for a district? What is the right amount for an REAA versus a municipal school district? What is the right amount for the state? I think those are good questions to wrestle with and ultimately come to some conclusion about, because what school districts spend on maintenance is right now just coming out of educational attainment. And so we have to think about one versus the other to some extent when it comes to how districts are budgeting. And I will say that, at least for local governments, what I've seen when they have had costs shifted to them from the state, unfunded mandates, new responsibilities, when school bond debt reimbursement isn't funded all the way, for instance, at 75% or less, it's the deferred maintenance fund that is often takes the first hit. And that's what's used to fund most of those or offset some of those unexpected things. So when you're choosing between students and school facilities, I imagine that most school districts are choosing students in the same way that local governments are choosing services to their residents.
Mr. Andreasen, we do have another question from Senator Brookman, but I do want to just invite folks on Monday, March 9th, the Task Force on Education Funding will be tackling major maintenance, capital improvement, and our current processes through the lists that are provided to DEED, and then the decision-making that occurs on how we select which projects get funded, and then, of course, talking about the 8 years of vetoes on those particular projects. Senator Bjorkman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair to Director Andreasen, thank you for pointing out the choices that local governments have, as well as a bit of disconnect between educational opportunities and achievement and dollars placed inside of school budgets. However, I think you just touched on an important concept there that is not lost on many people. As I've watched my local district and borough go through their budget processes many times, assemblies are faced with, would you like more dollars to go under the cap to provide for educational opportunities and improving or at least status quo outcomes, or would you like those dollars to go into major maintenance to fix siding and other things? And many times assemblies choose to pay for teachers in classrooms rather than major maintenance projects. As we talk about responsibility and who is responsible, 4 years after statehood, we had a decision as a state to make about who would pay for schools, and the Mandatory Borough Act was passed. And many areas of the state said, hey, we are responsible because the state tells us to be responsible to pay for our schools. Many, many years have passed since those boroughs were formed in 1964. Do you think that it's time to take a look at personal responsibility around the state again and look at who is possibly available and able to have their own local government and pay more for their local schools instead of it being mostly on the state dime?
Senator Bjorkman, through the chair, what AML members have said, and we have a resolution to this effect, is that fundamentally, borough formation is the greatest expression of local control, that where there's not borough formation, it's kind of ceding that control to the state, a distant decision maker. We have also said there's lots of ways to approach that, including to continue to respect local decision making. So I think the way that I would answer that is yes, to a large extent, where it makes sense, where we can continue that march kind of set out during statehood toward borough formation. I think that's, members have said that that's important, that's fair, that results in greater local decision making. And there's nuance to that, making sure that we're respecting the rights of voters and ultimately taxpayers along the way will be similarly important.
I apologize. We're going to keep moving on as we are getting perilously close to not giving enough time for your municipal leaders. But Representative Schwanke, when we get to the next few slides, I'll give you an opportunity.
And really, the next few slides are just to further illustrate some of the resources that are out there. So again, just pulling a snapshot from one community. This is St. Michael in the Bering Straits School District. This is how numbers will come to Department of Education. And for every school, then, you have something like this. I did just happen to look at Mount Edgecombe, and I saw some of the discussions being had right now in the Senate on this front. And I was surprised to see that $0 were in every category. And I don't have a good explanation of that. But I thought it was interesting. And all of this, again, is provided by the Department of Education at their facilities plan or capital planning website. The legislature has delivered a report every year, and it feels like my presentation always comes right before their presentation, and so I'm guessing at what they might say. This is what the Department of Education delivered in its 2025 report that's required by statute since 2013. This is what they said last year, and I imagine they'll say something like this again. That the state's put grant funding into our schools of over $1 billion over the last 15 year period. That funding has only been for a small portion of the expressed school capital funding need. $1 billion is a lot. And the need right now is $3 billion. And the full need is $6 billion. So a fair question, they say in that report, is what portion of the stated need for school capital projects was able to meet through that period? And you end up with about 15% of what districts applied for. It's worth unpacking that a little bit, and we have in previous presentations to know that a lot of districts don't submit those six-year plans, so you don't have all the data for what actual need looks like. And there's right now a disincentive by not funding those submissions. It's increasingly a disincentive to submit something that won't be funded, right? If your chances of seeing your school on that list at the end of the day is less than 15%, the $10,000, $15,000, $30,000 that go into the assessment needed to submit something, the costs outweigh the benefits. It's another kind of highlight from that report is that SB 64, so there was a school bond debt reimbursement moratorium for 10 years. That's been in place. And what that's meant is that instead of larger school districts or municipalities submitting school bond debt reimbursement requests, that's been directed into the school construction and major maintenance grant list. So you see larger districts competing within that space against small school districts.
Mr. Andreessen, can you remind us, as I know that there has been barriers to smaller districts getting on the list, I know that there's reports and things are needed. Can you touch briefly on that as well?
Yeah, Chair Tobin. So to submit something to Department of Education, the department has developed a process for what that needs to look like. So you have to have real projects. You have to have some level of design. You have to have a number of different criteria met. And it takes money to have a consultant or contractor, your facilities staff, spend the time to complete that application to deliver those reports. And I'll actually speak to that in an upcoming slide. This one, not necessarily that goes into all the metrics that are used by the department, but I want to. This comes from that last year's report by the department and the facilities division. Does the department trust the numbers? And right now, that report says not really. And there's qualifiers throughout, right? So the need as expressed by school districts. So it's not the need. It's here's what school districts say, and we're not really sure if that's the real number or not, but that's what we're using in our presentation to you. And the way to overcome the department's lack of trust in the need determined by school districts is to require more work that goes into the application. So the more design work that's accomplished ahead of time, the more confidence the department has that it can trust what districts are submitting, trust what districts are required in law to submit to the state. And if we're operating in a low-cost or low-trust environment, I think that makes identifying need really difficult. You can put all the numbers up here that you want, and then you can kind of shrug and say, well, but probably they're not fully accurate, and we could fund less than that, and it would be okay. So we have to get to a place where we've got a space where we trust school districts, that we trust the numbers, that we can feel secure enough in the need as it's expressed by those that we've assigned in law to submit that need to us, and create an incentive for them submitting the full and actual needs that they have, so that you've got actually that entire bucket of need and not just what they think you might fund. So when it comes to trusting those numbers, Representative Schwanke touched on that there are industry standards, and in the report that the department will submit or has submitted in the past, it talks about that you need 2% of the building value to meet the capital renewal needs of existing buildings. And additionally, due to repeated funding shortfalls, industry standards suggest that 1% additional is available for deferred maintenance. So at $11.8 billion, that was the amount that was identified in last year's report, you need about $353 million in each year's budget to address this need. And I think to Senator Bjorkman's reflection, right now that comes out of the BSA. It comes out of what you're hoping you achieve through investments into public education and its teachers and students and educational attainment ultimately. Over 15 years, the average has been more like $74 million, and then each district has those choices. Do we fix roofs, or do we hire a teacher? And that's, I think, the hard reality that many districts are faced with. Local governments are probably contributing to offsetting some of that, and we don't. I think we don't have the data enough on that. I'd love to see more work on what are local governments doing that isn't captured in some of these numbers. But ultimately, this a system of capital investment by the state is essential, and if we can't figure out how to address facilities separately and maybe outside of the BSA, we're not going to be able to address the annual needs that districts have for utilities, custodial staffing, preventive maintenance, and the small renewals that prevent those major failures that really come back to the legislature more urgently in future years.
Just one moment, Mr. Andreessen. I just want to make sure that we give Representative Schwanke a chance to ask the question that she had on the previous few slides.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the perspective on trying to tackle this and trying to figure out how we can better afford and how we can maybe separate out some of the maintenance costs. And I just kind of wanted to respond on one of the initial comments that has kind of come up, and I think it's a little bit misleading to pull out our EAAs in that they are not pulling their weight. I just wanted to point out very specifically that when it comes to impact aid, Alaska has an equalization formula that does redistribute some of that impact aid. So some of our rural districts are adjacent to very large federal pieces of land, which bring in a tremendous amount of impact aid that don't go directly to that district, but it is re-equalized around the state. And then also we have some other funding sources, obviously PILT, SRS, that weren't mentioned on your initial slide. And then just finally, a lot of misunderstanding on the concept of what the state brings in on property tax on the pipeline. And in the unorganized areas, it's northward of $60 million a year. So that money does in turn come back and help fund the REAA districts. So thank you.
Yeah, maybe Chair Tobin, just a point of clarification. I am not suggesting at all that REAAs aren't pulling their weight. So I want to be really clear about that. I think what I'm describing is that it's probably local governments have a different ability with municipal school districts to contribute to some of this need in a way that REAAs don't. But every district is going through exactly this scenario of, given the available dollars, do we choose between student needs and school facilities maintenance? So there are lots of tools that every district has and fund sources to pull in and address some of this, but there's always more to work with.
And Mr. Andreessen, we do have a question from Representative Elam.
Thank you. Yes, all the way around over here. Yes, sir. Thank you. I appreciate you coming out. Thanks for the presentation. This last slide or two has really kind of hit on a lot of the things that I have seen throughout the process where buildings, the roof, the boiler, the parking lot are at odds with what's going on within the classroom. Does AML, do municipal governments support the idea or the concept of separating out education funding from an academics type perspective for what's in the classroom versus facilities? Because all of that is currently in the foundation formula, and you know, you get it into the ADM, it functions okay if the ratio of square footage and students is more dialed in, but the moment you have any fluctuation, it becomes challenging.
Representative Elam, through the chair. Yes. And I think that's exactly where I'm leading, is that right now you've got this structural mismatch. You've got funding that's for students, for educational attainment, and everything has to pay for it. So there's a reliance by school districts on state funding. They're entirely dependent on the structure that you've set up. And O&M costs aren't based necessarily on ADM, and right now there's that tension. So I'm going to get to an answer, I think, through this in the next slide. So when we're thinking about facilities, we have to think beyond ADM. We have to think about the building inventory, its life cycle and condition, place-based drivers, and climate that is really more about heating dominant energy loads and weather-driven deterioration. They don't scale linearly with ADM. And in fact, when you're building schools, that footprint is lumpy. And I actually had to like figure out what lumpy meant. But what I think what we're trying to describe is that when you're adding a boiler, you're not doing a boiler per student allocation. You're doing a boiler for as many students as that boiler can support. And I think that's true for a lot of our facilities, is that you're not scaling by student number. You need four walls and a roof and all the things that go into it. And that base facilities allocation ultimately needs to be inventory based and place adjusted rather than purely per pupil. So what AML would suggest is recognizing all of that actually what the state could do is implement something like a base facilities allocation. And we've suggested something like this in the past and have put more work into it since. Alaska's Uniform Chart of Accounts that the Department of Education provides to school districts has a function 600. This is operations and maintenance that has all the things that could end up in a bucket that is based on or funded by a base facilities allocation. I think what's important to this is we're not pulling money out of the BSA. We are adding base facilities allocation to recognize that ultimately more funding is needed for the system of public education, and as a system, we're going to add some amount of dollars that's available to focus on this so that this isn't coming at the expense of student achievement or that student achievement isn't being lessened by these kinds of expenses. So I think you've got a framework to actually split out those costs in some effective way, and we've done some additional research for what a formula could look like, and I'm happy to kind of come back to the committee or chairs and talk through that. But I would say just for the 1% and not even 3% of value, if you could dedicate that much to deferred maintenance or for this, you're talking about $115 million, which would be meaningful. And you can think about it while it's directed at facilities. Ultimately, it's benefiting students.
Representative Story.
Thank you, Chair Tobin. Through the chair, thank you, Mr. Andreessen, for your comments and thoughts here today. They're very important. And what it's making me think as I've been sitting here is hearing the testimony in Tribal Affairs 2 weeks ago about how school buildings are more than the learning environments, They are community centers. They are emergency evacuation centers. We saw that so much in the slides that were shown to us. And so when I think what we're looking at this facility is, I think we have to think about maybe a shared responsibility in our base facilities with municipalities because it is more than the learning environments, to recognize that some way. And I've talked to many people who in other governments who are sleeping on the gym floors because it's the only place to stay when they go out to a community to do their work. And I also sit here and I think about the amount of money that public dollars drive private investment and private workers too. And I think of contractors who used to, when we funded facilities more, would that work would help them in their businesses. And it sort of cycles around because it helps us keep our facilities up, and it also helps businesses, the private-public partnership. So I've had many thoughts, and I'm thank you for allowing me to share those.
Thank you. And I apologize, I'm doing a time check here as we want to move on to our invited municipal leaders, and we have some folks who have to leave us for finance.
I'm done. In conclusion, you know the problem statement. I mean, I continue to appreciate the good work of the House and Senate Education Committees and the Education Funding Task Force. We know that there has been persistent underfunding. We know what that looks like. We could talk about lots of other things, but I'm not going to. Really appreciate the opportunity to talk a little bit more about facilities today. I'm glad to see that on the agenda in the coming weeks and can contribute more to that then. But I'm going to leave the rest of the words up to municipal officials who deal with this on a daily basis. And beyond facilities to kind of that broader scope of just how important schools are within our communities. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Andreessen. And if we do have some moments here at the end, we'll invite you back up for any additional questions. We now will move on to our invited testimony from mayors and municipal leaders from across the state. We're going to change the order a little bit so we can ensure that some of our lawmakers who have to leave us have the chance to listen to their municipal leaders. So joining us now is Mayor Beth Weldon from the City and Borough of Juneau. If you could please identify yourself for the record and begin your testimony when you are ready.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Beth Weldon, Mayor of the City and Borough of Juneau, and thank you, Senator Keel, for making me have to go first.
Madam Chair, it's a pleasure.
Yes. Good morning, and thank you for the chance to speak with you all today. As local leaders, we all know that education is fundamental, not only for our students, but for our fiscal and economic health of every municipality of Alaska. So my first topic is education funding, where things actually stand. This year's education debate is less chaotic than last year, but the underlying issues remain the same. While the legislature made a significant increase to the BSA last year, thank you for that, it was really just equal to the one-time funding from the year before. School districts across Alaska remain in deficit funding with major cuts being deliberated. So while we've seen progress, we don't yet have the predictable inflation-responsive funding formula AML has long supported. AML's resolutions again call for stabilizing K-12 funding and tying the BSA to inflation and to end the cycle of an annual uncertainty. From the municipal perspective, this is critical. When the BSA lags inflation, school districts turn to cities and boroughs to help backfill, with local property taxpayers carrying costs the state historically shared. And in general, we feel that directly. Every time the state doesn't keep the pace, the city and borough of Juneau faces pressures to increase in local contributions or watch programs and staff erode. That dynamic isn't sustainable, and especially for a community already managing high fixed costs, housing pressures, and other local needs, including disaster mitigation. Number two, school facilities, our looming challenge. The second major statewide issue is facilities, especially school bond debt reimbursement and major maintenance. AML has been clear. The state must reestablish predictable participation in the school capital funding. For general, this is not a theoretical concern. We have aging school buildings, expensive deferred maintenance, and large capital needs. When the state steps back, the burden shifts entirely to local taxpayers, and we simply cannot absorb major multi-million dollar projects without state partnership. Restoring bond debt reimbursement would allow communities like ours to plan responsibly, project existing assets, and avoid deep structural deterioration that costs more in the long run. I won't be as long as Nils, promise. Number three, policy changes and unfunded mandates. This year also brings broad policy proposals such as open enrollment, charter schools, correspondent programs, special education services, and reading proficiency incentives. The Alaska Reads Act continues to expand early literacy requirements, adding workload for districts and municipalities without always providing matching resources. AMIL has documented a long list of unfunded mandates that strain local budgets. Genoa is seeing this firsthand. As a capital city, our school district must support high-need students, a transient population, and the cost of delivering education in a geographically constrained environment. When new policies arrive without funding, the pressure lands on CBJ to fill the gaps. So I'll close with what I believe is AML's unified message. Alaska needs a BSA that is adequate, stable, and inflation responsive. The state must return to being a reliable partner on school facilities. Policy changes must come with funding, not new burdens on municipalities. For Geno and for every community representative here, education is more than a line item. It's central to our workforce, our economic future, and our ability to retain families. A strong state-municipal partnership is the only way to secure that future. So thank you for all the work you do, your commitment to our communities, and I look forward to the conversations, the upcoming conversations that we'll all have with you.
Thank you, Mayor Walden. Is there any questions? Senator Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Mayor, we've talked a lot about facilities. Maybe I'll just stick there. The loss of that bond debt reimbursement for 10 years and then sort of unreliable funding, can you talk about what your local budget is doing to make up for that? I'll leave it open like that.
Okay. Thank you for that, Senator Keel, through the chair. So what we did, and I'm not sure if you were still on the assembly when this happened, we dedicate at least $1 million a year, which according to the school board president isn't enough, but we do $1 million every year for maintenance. And in the last, I want to say 5 years, we have replaced 3.5 roofs, and we've also replaced 2 boilers. But to give you an example, I'm taking your question and moving a little further. When we consolidated and had the school district had to give us back 3 buildings, one of the buildings that we're currently working with Clinkett and Haida to do child care in, which is a great thing, that's going to cost $1 million just to renovate. And we also found out the fuel tank, underground fuel tank, is leaking fuel. So that has an expensive price tag to replace that. Another building is sitting idle because the estimated cost of asbestos abatement is $20 million, and we just don't have that. So the third one is being used, but you can see that the deferred maintenance is just adding up.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Keel. Thank you so much for joining us this
thank
morning,
you.
And thank you
appreciate
for going
all your
first.
Time.
We'll now hear from the Denali Borough Mayor, Chris Noel. After Mr. Noel, we will hear from the City of Anderson Mayor, Katie Grebe. Mr. Noel, if you could please identify yourself for the record and begin your testimony when you are ready.
Thank you. Excuse me. Thank you, Madam Chair, co-chairs, members of the committee, for this opportunity. For the record, my name is Chris Noel, and I serve as mayor of the Denali Borough. In addition, I do serve on the AML board, and I'm a parent of 2 preschool-age children. Thank you again for the opportunity to testify. And I'll just emphasize, I appreciate the both bodies getting together so we have this wider audience as we're here for the AML Legislative Conference. In the Denali Borough, through the collaborative efforts of the school board, superintendent, and administration, and frontline teaching staff, we are achieving. Yesterday, we heard from Education Commissioner Dr. Dina Bishop about the important work of the going on in the Department of Education and results of recent educational assessments. Based on measures such as the STAR assessments, MCLAS, and graduation rates, the school district is seeing great success. Thank you.
Supporting our component unit, the Denali Borough School District, is the largest expense the borough has. We consistently fund and are fortunate to have the means up to the maximum allowable. This is over 40% of our general governmental budget. The district and borough are fiscally responsible. We have the means to make purposeful investments in students. Currently, the district is managing around a 6 to 7% budget deficit. I wanted to move on. The sole licensed daycare facility in the borough has also recently partnered with the district to provide preschool. The Denali Preschool and Learning Center has, for decades, operated in Healy, and we have recently heard about the ongoing challenges they face to recruit and retain staff, meet required ratios, and keep the lights on. In the next borough budget cycle, we anticipate looking at how the borough can do more to help support this critical service. The BSA boost was needed, and I thank you all for raising the floor, and there's still opportunity to do more, as we've heard today. Why do our schools matter to us? Again, this has also come up. Across the state, our three brick-and-mortar school buildings are more than just places of learning. They're our largest physical asset. They serve as more than educational institutions. They each host community libraries, and these libraries are places of community connection, including holding public meetings, craft nights, story hours, to name a few. They have shop space for career and technical education classes, and they house visiting students during sports tournaments. The buildings also serve, as has been mentioned, as our primary evacuation shelters and are increasingly being used as both a shelter and emergency operations center during summer wildfire season. While the borough and district have successfully focused on major maintenance projects over the years, it takes just a quick walkthrough of our buildings to see the ongoing deferred maintenance needs. So I'd ask the committees to consider how you can continue to support and partner with districts as we invest in major maintenance needs. We'd also ask you to consider moving the preschool count from one half to one full child. And as we talk about education in the same way decisions about the size of the PFD impact each resident, decisions about education funding impact each community, each with unique needs and challenges as they work to create educational opportunities for their kids. And my hope is we'll continue to focus on investment in students. Today's students are tomorrow's leaders sitting where we sit, making decisions on behalf of our communities and state. And I thank you, co-chairs and members of the committee, for this opportunity.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your testimony. Are there any questions? Thank you again for joining us here. We'll now hear from the City of Anderson, Mayor Katie Grebe, and after that, we'll hear from the City of Bethel, Mayor Rose Henderson.
Thank you. For the record, thank you. For the record, my name is Katie Grebe. I'm currently serving as, thank you members of, for your time today. My name is Katie Grebe, and I'm currently serving as the mayor in the city of Anderson. I'm also a parent of two pre-K kids. First, I want to thank you for all of the hard work you guys put in as a body to increase the BSA last year. Last year, when I testified before this committee, Anderson only had six K through 12 and two pre-K students, which left us wondering if this would be the year that we'd start to hear serious conversations about closure again. This year, we have 13 K through 12 and four pre-K students enrolled. This is exciting for our community, but it isn't quite enough to curb those closure discussions. Thankfully, we are in a borough and school district that have been supportive of small schools, but we know without an increase in enrollment and funding that our school will continue to face possible closure. Unlike many districts, our school is aged, but it's in relatively good shape and would be a waste to close. Our community has worked very hard to bring homeschool kids in to participate in after-school activities, 4-H being very, very popular. And the city and high school also partnered on an engaging CTE project this year. Our five high school students are building 10x10 cabins to house the firefighters for Anderson Summer Wildland Fire Program. The teacher and students have been able to utilize the cabin project in many ways with their curriculum, from 3D printing, to woodworking and math, and to presenting the project to the city council and school board for public speaking. This project has been an incredible opportunity to partner with the school, but to also give the kids a project that they can be proud of for years to come that greatly benefits our community. This type of experience with CTE programs should be available to all Alaskan students. The ability our students had to work in a stocked wood shop with all the tools and a functioning facility should be the norm across our state, and it isn't. The conditions of our schools, especially in rural Alaska, is abysmal. The lack of funding for major school maintenance just compounds the problem each year that it isn't addressed. Our state is facing yet another year of outward migration, in part because many families are leaving in search of better opportunities for their children. This heavily affects our rural communities where our populations are small already. I know it is hard to have these discussions over and over again, kind of like our closure talks. But I encourage you to think outside the box, get it creative, work together, and find ways to make education, major school maintenance, particularly a priority for this body. Not just for our students who are our future, but also to help battle the outward migration that is already hitting our small and rural communities incredibly hard. Again, thank you for allowing me this opportunity to speak to you.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Ms. Grebe. Is there any questions? Thank you again for joining us. We'll now hear from the City of Bethel, Mayor Rose Henderson. After that, we will hear from the Kodiak Island Borough Mayor, Jared Griffin.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Rose Henderson, and I serve as the mayor of the City of Bethel. And I'm sorry, I'll be reading from my phone, so I probably won't look up very often. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today on behalf of the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta region. In the YK Delta, our schools are more than educational facilities. They are critical infrastructure. They serve as community gathering places, emergency shelters, cultural centers, and the backbone of our regional economy. When education funding is unstable or inadequate, the impacts extend far beyond the classroom. We see difficulty recruiting and retaining teachers. We see deferred maintenance that increases long-term costs. We see families making the difficult decision to leave their home, communities in search of opportunity and stability. Outward migration weakens our local workforce, strains urban infrastructure, and erodes the cultural fabric of rural Alaska. Strong, well-funded schools help families stay. They help preserve indigenous languages and traditions. They prepare the next generation of local leaders, healthcare workers, educators, and skilled tradespeople who are essential to sustaining the region. The obligation to maintain school operations and infrastructure is a constitutional obligation for the state. The state must determine how to meet that obligation without shifting the burden onto rural residents. Investing in rural education is not optional. It is essential to protecting the lives, culture, and long-term stability of Alaska's community. And I thank you, Madam Chair, for your time and committee members for having me here today.
Thank you so much, Mayor Henderson. Are there any questions? Seeing none, we'll move on to Kodiak Island Borough Mayor Jared Griffin. After that, we'll hear from Ketchikan Gateway Borough Deputy Manager Sienna Smith. Mr. Griffin, if you could please identify yourself for the record and begin your testimony when you are ready.
Thank you. Yes, for the record, my name is Jared Griffin. Chair Tobin, Co-Chair Stevens, Co-Chair Himshute, and Story and other members of the Senate and House committees, thank you for the sustained work that you're doing to strengthen public education in Alaska. Your work does not go unnoticed in Kodiak. My name is Jared Griffin. I'm the mayor of the Kodiak Island Borough. I'm the parent of a fifth grader and the parent of four other children who have successfully gone through the Kodiak public school system. I've lived in Kodiak for nearly 20 years, but I grew up on the east side of Anchorage. I went to Susitna Elementary. Go Wolverines. I'm speaking as someone who's experienced Alaska in more than one region and more than one season of my life. Outside of the borough government, I also coach the Kodiak High School Shakespeares. We are the six-time Division I drama state champions, and some of you have even given us a legislative citation or two over the years. So I appreciate that. So I spend a lot of time in the school world with students, with families, teachers, and some of you are also educators. So you know that the practical realities don't always fit neatly into spreadsheets. Public education is one of the core ways that Alaska keeps faith with its children. No matter where they live or what burdens that their families carry or what challenges they bring to the classroom. And that promise depends on two virtues that always don't get enough attention in policy debates, and those are trust and stability. Trust is what allows communities to vote yes on long-term facility investments and maintenance and to plan responsibly. Stability is what allows boroughs to budget appropriately and schools to recruit talent and build programs that aren't constantly interrupted by crisis budgeting. These are not soft virtues. These are structural. These are practical. What I tell my writing students is that ethos is everything. And so that's why I'm here to speak today on a couple of things, the school bond debt reimbursement. And HB 261. Kodiak experienced a shortfall with bond debt reimbursement last summer when Deed kind of unilaterally cut the legislature's 75% reimbursement appropriation to 69%. Deed had thought that there was another borough that was going to approve and request reimbursement, and that borough did not. So regardless, the decision made left us with an unexpected loss that we still had to cover because we had already passed our budget by then. And so that obligation didn't disappear, so we had to dig into the only place where we could, our own R&R fund, to balance around that surprise. And so I think that's a recent example that illustrates the impacts of the state not living faithfully to our collective goal to strengthen our towns and our villages and our schools. And so what that means is that we had to push some of our needs further out. Chiniac School needs a new water system, fire alarm fixes in our village schools, village buildings, especially Port Lyons, and our pool. Can you imagine a community like Kodiak with no functioning pool where we train swimmers and water safety? So, you know, that's the practical result when state funding is unpredictable. Local government is forced to triage and defer maintenance. And that grows, right, until it becomes larger and much more expensive. And so this might look modest in Juneau, but in Kodiak it becomes quite a rift for us. So we would like to see some backfilling that would help us, or you know, to help us pressure Deed to right their error last year and backfill that FY26 shortfall, and of course fully fund going forward. We also in Kodiak have a couple of concerns about HB 261 and how it will operate in districts that include multiple village schools, such as Kodiak. And we completely understand the goal, right? Districts need predictability. HB 261 is trying to give districts that that steadier base, and that intent makes complete sense to us. Here's Kodiak's problem is in our village schools, as many of you know, right, our village, our enrollment can swing sharply year to year. In a school of 10 to 20 students, a change of 5 students is not marginal. And so, but a stabilization method can kind of lag reality. Our two risks are that funding school operations as though it's larger than it actually is when a family moves out, who have a lot of kids. And then when a family moves in, who have a lot of kids, school grows suddenly. That 3-year average may still sit below that threshold, and we won't have the flexibility to meet that real-time count that requires. So if you're still considering that bill, please look at adding maybe a village school guardrails for schools at a small site threshold. you know, let the stabilized count stand unless current year enrollment deviates meaningfully by a set number or percentage, perhaps, or cap, you know, how far above or below the current year that stabilized count can drift. I think our goal is the same, is to keep stability, but don't let stabilization prevent a village school from having to respond to, you know, sudden real changes in cohorts. Thank you for your time. Kodiak is happy to work with the committees on language and intent while making it all work for our schools, especially our village schools. And to work on what is the best vehicle to fix and backfill bond debt reimbursement and fully fund going forward. When the state is predictable, municipalities can plan. We can plan responsibly. Voters can invest with confidence. And schools can focus on our future mayors and our future legislators instead of instability. I'm an English major, so I'm going to leave you with a quote, because that's what we do. This one's from Tennyson. It is the little rift within the lute that by and by will make the music mute. Each time we don't fully fund schools, fully fund bond debt, that is a rift in our small, remote community. Please don't mute our students, our future mayors, future legislators, our future leaders. Let's make music. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Griffin. We do have a question from Senator Yunt.
Thank you, through the chair. So I just wanted to touch on the school bond debt reimbursement portion again, and I thank you for bringing that up. I'm very grateful for the 4 years I was able to spend on our local assembly prior to coming here, and this was a very large area of frustration for myself as being the local assembly is the appropriator and we have to fund local education. And I can tell you, so for those that are home right now watching that may not understand what it actually means when the state does not hold up to its end of the deal, that's going right on your mill rate at home. That's going on your property taxes at home. And it's already frustrating enough that the state of Alaska's budget in most cases, and maybe even all, is adopted after your local district's budget. So a local district is adopting their mill rate because they got to send out their property tax cards and oftentimes don't even know what the state's going to do yet. That's why you'll never see me support one-time money either. Put it in the BSA or don't do it, right? One-time money comes after, you don't know what's coming. School bond debt reimbursement, when that does not go from the state of Alaska to the local districts, it's going right on your property taxes. That year, that's what's going to happen. It's coming in the next 12 months on your property taxes because it's not an option to not pay your bills. So when the state of Alaska and local governments made this agreement long ago, the state didn't sign the lending documents. The local governments did. They can't default because their credit score is going to go through the floor. Everything they borrow in the future is going to cost way more. That's not an option. Failure is actually not an option. So it's the local property taxpayers that pick up the bill when the state of Alaska fails. And not paying school bond debt reimbursement is a massive failure. So I hope it never happens again.
Thank you, Senator Yunt. Thank you very much for your words. And I do hope in the future we'll be making beautiful music together.
Thank you.
We now will hear from the Ketchikan Gateway Borough Deputy Manager, Ms. Smith. After that, we will hear from Northwest Arctic Borough Assembly Member Craig McConnell. Ms. Smith, thank you for joining us. If you could please identify yourself for the record and begin your comments when you are ready.
Good morning. Thank you to the committee for this opportunity to speak. For the record, my name is Sina Smith. I'm the Assistant Borough Manager and former Finance Director for the Ketchikan Gateway Borough. I'm going to speak to a slightly different issue than previous speakers, and I'd like to talk to the issue of fiscal accountability on the part of school districts. Our borough provides roughly $12 million, or about 25% of the budget for the Ketchikan Gateway Borough School District through our RLC and discretionary funding. To put that in perspective, our general fund revenue is only about $20 million. 100% of area-wide property taxes, secure rural schools, and some other minor revenue provide the local funds for education in the borough. The district is more than double the size of the borough in terms of budget and staffing. In the past, deed monitored budgets and fund balances and served out consequences for blowing a budget. A superintendent's certification was in jeopardy if he or she could not manage the budget. Someone in the school district was held personally accountable for adhering to the budget. I'm not sure when or why that monitoring stopped, but we are at the point that there is very little accountability for a school district's budget. These blown budgets also serve to exceed the statutory funding cap. DEED essentially allows beyond the cap funding by mediating the negotiation of loans between districts and boroughs to allow beyond the cap funding to face no consequences. Instead, they sanction the spending that occurred in violation of statute by allowing multi-year repayment plans. This serves to insulate the district from what is otherwise a violation of law. Our district has seriously overrun its budget twice in the last 8 years. The first time, starting just before and culminating right after COVID, the debt got to $4.8 million, or about 8% of the district's annual budget and nearly 25% of the borough's annual budget. The assembly put the district on a repayment plan, and we thought the debt was going to be repaid this year. Instead, we learned the district has accumulated debt in a different area of the balance sheet, and it's now $5.4 million. Our assembly is currently considering the district's funding for next year and will require repayment of the debt, which will result in real impacts to the district. But the assembly is taking action for next year based on what happened last year, and although we don't know yet what this year's performance is, it will be a miracle if they don't actually add to the debt. Under the current arrangement, DEED is no longer enforcing state statute, and that is falling to the borough by default. However, the borough has no enforcement ability. In this case, the power of the purse strings does not exist. The district is not a separate legal entity from the borough. If the district defaults on its obligations, the borough is still responsible to pay. It doesn't matter how much was appropriated or not appropriated. The borough is still on the hook. So my comments are not meant to imply that the schools do not need additional funding, whether it's for education or facilities. But no matter how robust or how slim a budget is, it needs to be adhered to. So I'm asking this committee to require enforcement of fiscal standards relating to budgets, appropriations, and spending authority limits. The borough needs help from DEED in enforcing state statute the way they used to do. Maybe the softening of enforcement was intended to help the districts, but at some point, help turns into enabling. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Himshue.
Thank you, Chair Tobin. Through the chair, Ms. Smith, can you tell me what DEED used to do? What changed?
So DEED used to monitor the school district's budgets, and they may be monitoring now, but they're apparently not taking any action for consequences. And a school district's superintendent's certification were in jeopardy if they didn't adhere to that budget. They could pull the cert, deny the renewal of a cert, and then apparently that's no longer happening.
Follow up?
Thank you. Do you know of instances where that certification was pulled?
Not off the top of my head, but we can probably find out and through Director Andres and get that information to the committee.
That would be helpful. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Himshue. Representative Story.
Hi, yes, thank you. Through the chair, thank you for your testimony today. I am wondering, the district audits that they get and are required to do by law, are there findings that you know from your school board's budgeting from their yearly audit?
No. The auditors do not care about or enforce spending authority. That's not within their purview. If there are findings in our district's current audit, they're relatively minor.
Senator Bjorkman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you very much, Ms. Smith, for being here today. My question, I have a couple, but we'll start off with a objective one. How close is the Ketchikan Gateway Borough, both this current fiscal year and your projected budget for this next fiscal year, at funding to the cap?
For the last 5+ years, we have funded to the cap, but unfortunately, part of that has been used to prepay to repay prior debt. Any available, what we call gap to the cap, was used to pay off debt from prior years. If the Assembly had chosen to write off all of that $4.8 million in the year that it surfaced, it would have they would have either had to cut the school district's budget by a full $4.8 million, or it would have exceeded the cap by that much. So we were required to, in order to avoid violating the cap, which had, you know, sort of in an invisible way previously happened, we paid that, we had the school district pay that back over the years. We actually wrote it off over the course of the years.
Very good.
Follow up.
Do you think it would be helpful if Deed used the financial data that it received to create a more user-friendly, forward-facing internet website that could clearly display how school districts are spending dollars on educational purposes, the physical plant, insurance, so that the public could more clearly track what is spent on, for what purpose and when? Other states do this. They have very user-friendly interfaces where the public can go in and compare schools, they can compare districts. Do you think that might be helpful in thwarting some of this problem you're having?
Deed actually does have a pretty good website that I use frequently to look up various information. Unfortunately, right now, I can't seem to find annual financial reports for districts. I've thought that I was previously able to do that. They may still be there somewhere, but they're not easy to find. And my district has in the past not been particularly stringent about putting those on their own website, so that then makes the accountability even harder to follow.
And so, by rights then, would you support a user-friendly, visually appealing website that clearly shows to the public budgeted amounts, actual spend, and then audited financials?
Yes, and I would include spending authority and whether or not they adhered to the spending authority, and appropriations.
Very good. It's coming soon to a bill near you.
Thank you, Senator Bjorkman. Representative Schwanke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Ms. Smith. years ago, the Copper River School District actually declared bankruptcy. Is that an option for Ketchikan?
Through the chair, that's actually a very frightening question. The school district is not a separate legal entity from the borough, so does that mean the borough has to declare bankruptcy?
That's a good question. I don't know the answer to that.
We will definitely work in trying to find that answer for folks. Any follow-up?
No.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
We will now hear from our final presenter, from Northwest Arctic Borough, Assemblymember Craig McConnell. Mr. McConnell, if you could please identify yourself for the record and begin your testimony when you are ready.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Craig McConnell. I'm from Kotzebue. I'm not going to read to you this morning. I guess I'm not that organized. But I've got some notes here. I work for the, currently I serve on the Northwest Arctic Borough Assembly. I'm the president of our assembly. But prior to that, I worked for the Northwest Arctic Borough School District for 35 years as a teacher, athletic director, coach. And for 24 of those years, I was a facility director. So I'm very familiar with the issues that are being talked about today. Our borough, like all school districts, are in a very difficult situation. We do a lot for our school district. Currently we're paying debt on $92 million in bond debt. Last year we paid $9.5 million to the school district to supplement what you fund. We subsidize the school district's water sewer. We pay 50% of their water sewer bill. We pay the match on all their state and federal construction projects, and our Native Corporation pays $1.5 million towards student activities. So up until now, we've been able to do a pretty good job of running our schools, but where we get our money, the Red Dog Mine, is in decline. And the decline is going to be very dramatic over the next 5 years. And so we don't know what we're going to do. Well, we know what we're not going to be able to pay as much as we have been able to pay toward our school district. So, and they're cutting, just like all school districts, they're cutting teachers, they're cutting everything they can cut to keep up with inflation. And so I know that you're in a difficult position. Your funding is limited too. The one thing I would say that we really need is the school bond debt reimbursement. Without that, we can't maintain our schools. With that funding, we can go after different grants and capital funding that help us maintain our schools. But right now, we've got a school in Shungnak that is just closed down. The water sewers froze up. They haven't had an open the school's not been open in a month. And so when that happens, we have to jump in as a borough and try and fix it, because the village can't do it. And so the school ends up, and the borough, we end up doing it. Otherwise, we don't have school. Our schools are hotels out there. We are everything. Co-chair Story, you spoke very accurately earlier when you talked about our schools are everything, serve all purposes. They do, and so it's without them the village collapses. So we've got to keep those schools open. You know, I want to say one thing. Mount Edgecombe has made the news here recently, and I coach basketball for the better part of 30 years, and my two children graduated from Mount Edgecombe High School, so I'm very familiar with that school because I'd go and visit them and I'd walk through the dorms in the school, and I've heard Mount Edgecombe described as deplorable, and I don't discount that, but there are 100 Mount Edgecombes out there, I'll have you know. I traveled during all those years I coached. I traveled throughout the state, and we'd sleep in schools. And so I'd get a real close look and feel of those schools. There are a lot worse schools out there than Mount Edgecombe, and I just want people to know that, because Mount Edgecombe's in the news. Mount Edgecombe's not that bad in comparison. Those schools out in rural Alaska are way, way worse. Trying to run school with no heating controls, no fire alarm systems, no water sewer, in a lot of cases. So we really need your help. Thank you for the veto override last year. We may need it again. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Mr. McConnell. Although I am from Nome, I will say go Huskies. We do have a few extra moments here, Mr. Andreasen, if you would like to join us back here at the dais for any additional questions. Are additional questions from committee members? Senator Bjorkman.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Mr. Andreasen, welcome back. Glad you're here. We're thankful to have heard from school districts that represent roughly about 10% of Alaska's population here today. Because we increased funding through the formula last year, some districts saw an increase in funding last year, but overall state spending on K-12 education was down about 2.5%. Many districts saw less funding, and districts including Fairbanks, Mat-Su, the Kenai Peninsula, and Anchorage are going to see millions less in funding this year. Anchorage will be down about $9 million. Fairbanks, $6.8 million. Kenai Peninsula, $4.2 million. Mat-Su, $4.4 million. As a result, largely of increase assessed values on their property. And that means that the people in those boroughs will either be forced to pay more taxes when people in other parts of the state don't pay personal property taxes on their homes and properties, or they just have to eat the fact that their students are going to have less educational opportunities because assessed values in their communities have gone up. Some might say that this function of falling funding is a result of declining enrollment. However, that's only a fraction of the cost of this funding decline. The Kenai Peninsula especially, their declining funding from state funds is $3.8 million out of the 4.1, 4.2-ish. That's the vast majority. Is AML moving forward any kind of policy position or any kind of perspective on this phenomenon of our funding formula that really is a pretty large cost shift from the state to local governments? Do you guys have any proposed solutions to deal with this shift that through the formula essentially demands that districts, municipalities, I should say, raise taxes or simply fund schools less?
Through the chair, Senator Bjorkman, I almost thought we were going to have a property tax discussion, which I wasn't prepared for, but would be excited about. I will say, I mean, maybe on the property tax front, we've actually got a property tax working group right now that's kind of working through what does full value determination look like, how do exemptions affect current taxpayers. What is the role of property tax relative to the required local contribution and school funding? So it might be a question that I can put back to that working group of assessors and finance officers and municipal managers and mayors. I think what we have talked about at AML is unpacking the formula in such a way that we really understand what, you know, what that required local contribution is. I mean, I mentioned impact aid. What is the impact of the state's use of those dollars to offset its contribution? What is reduced state funding, like that intersection in effect when state funding goes down or is offset by local taxpayer dollars? Like, whose job is it ultimately is really kind of what we're wrestling with. And is it fair? Like, is there equity kind of in that system for those with a property tax to pick up a greater burden than elsewhere? Those are the questions that we do wrestle with quite a bit. I don't have a policy proposal to present you today, but it's certainly something that we've done enough work on that we could come back and talk through a little bit more of here's ways to maybe think about that in some effective manner, and maybe to help especially the Education Funding Task Force to think through some of the next steps when it comes to a formula.
Thank you. Follow-up?
Thank you very much, Mr. Andreasen. Yeah, as we look at the cause of budget deficits around the state, Anchorage is looking at a $90 million deficit. I'm thankful that my district is significantly smaller than that. But a large driver in these deficits, including in the senator from the Matsu's district, as well as my own, and the representative to my right here, it is caused by this function in the formula where assessed values go up, and that means that the state contribution goes down.
Yep.
I think that's what we should be looking at and working on, although I'm thankful that we were able to put a bigger number into the formula. That did not deliver more dollars to kids' educational opportunities. It just didn't. So I think we need to be looking for solutions on that front to actually improve educational opportunities and then increase outcomes.
Yeah. Through the chair, Senator Bjorkman, I think that those larger school districts and population centers matter as part of this conversation, and they weren't represented in discussion today, but I know they each could have contributed their own perspective and probably pointed to the fact that more state funding in the form of the BSA didn't translate into funding improvements within their school districts. And that's kind of crazy, right? That the intent of the legislature is to better fund public education. and the fact that local valuation increases don't translate into more dollars for districts. There's something wrong with that process, and I think they each would have pointed to the structural deficiencies then in their current budget cycle to try to address.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Andreessen. Any additional questions? Seeing none, any wrap-up comments?
I just really appreciate this opportunity. Again, you heard a lot of different approaches to public education, and that was kind of the point, that there's no kind of one-size-fits-all approach to how local governments think about their role and responsibility relative to school districts. And not all of our members have municipal school districts. All benefit from the state's support for a system of public education. But they do come to it from a variety of different in a variety of different ways. So that means that for some, it's like we're really excited about what's going on in our schools and the work that our students are achieving. For some, it's it is a spreadsheet, right? It's the dollars and cents, and we're trying our best at the local level to make sure that we're delivering to districts. We brought up accountability in our initial slide. And yes, that's attendance and that's testing. And it's what's the role of local governments in managing budgets for political subdivisions of municipalities. So we're thinking on all those different levels. And all of it points to local governments probably have a greater role in this process than we often achieve, since so much of it is left to state decision making and ultimately kind of statutory and budgeting activities. Local governments should be at the table and appreciate this opportunity to do exactly that today. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Mr. Andreessen. Representative Story.
Thank you. Through the chair, I did think of a question, and it touched on a little bit of the public testimony from people here today, and that was the changes recommended in House Bill 261, which is the three-year averaging or the prior year ADM, averaging of the ADM. And this was recommended by Augenblick, Palish and Associates in their 2015 funding review of our foundation formula, and also in a presentation that the task force had in November. And what I heard from districts and from municipalities, excuse me, and boroughs, I just wanted to say, did I hear correctly today? And I don't know how much you discussed that, but the funding process is broken. I heard testimony that we get the numbers after municipalities pass their budgets, and then afterwards the state comes in if they're making any changes in district funding. So people are looking to have the funding structure, the number earlier for districts, and that's part of what the bill recommends, is having the July 1st districts, school districts, knowing their numbers so everyone can plan around that. So I heard that, and then I also heard testimony, can there be some sort of mechanism to adjust for if there was a large infusion of students? Did I hear correctly on that?
Yeah, Rep. Story, through the chair. I think that's something that we can follow up on. I didn't hear dissimilarly. I heard the same thing. So we'll chase that down and get a better some feedback from municipalities and districts for what should timing look like and counts, and how that matters, how that integrates into each district's process. And I think the same principle applies, that one size doesn't always fit all, and it's not just for districts, but it's local governments who are kind of developing property tax and their own budgets independently from where districts are at. So we've got to like line all those up and across every single community. So we'll follow up and get more information to you.
Thank you. Senator Yunt.
Thank you, through the chair. So, I raised my mic thinking it was wrap-up comments time. So if it's not, I'll wait.
Oh, no, we're definitely in wrap-up comments.
Okay, well, thank you. So I'm sure everybody here has seen this. This is the last 10 years of budgets for the state of Alaska, right? Legislative finance puts this out. I hope that everybody studies this daily. You show me a family's budget, and I'll show you a family's priorities. You show me a government's budget, and I, too, will show you a government's priorities. This is the last 10 years, but I want to speak specifically to the last seven. The governor's office has the governor's floor, over 50% increase in spending. The legislature, over 50% increase in spending. Department of Corrections, over 50% increase in spending. Education, flat. All right? So I just, this trickles down to the local governments. If the state of Alaska is failing miserably when it comes to funding education, which I do believe we are failing, then local districts have a decision to make, right? When people look at where they're going to live, where they're going to raise their families, they're looking at income levels and jobs. They're looking at how much a housing costs, what type of schools they can raise their children in, and crime levels. Those are basically your only four things that families are going to look at, or at least the top four, right? When we don't fund school bond debt reimbursement, that when we don't do capital improvements, when we don't fund improvements to our infrastructure, what that means is your local districts have to choose between hiring teachers and fixing boilers. You know, the legislature passed a phenomenal piece of education legislation last year, and one of the amendments to it was setting a threshold to how many students per teacher you could have, right? Student per teacher ratio. If we want to increase test scores, and I know we all do, it requires an investment, and it requires teachers. When the local district and the local assemblies have to choose between deferred maintenance and hiring teachers, the trickle-down effect is you're not going to get as good a test scores. And that's not anything that I'm proud of, I can tell you that. So I just, like I said, you show me your family's budget, I'll show you your family's priorities. You show me your government's budget, and I'll do the same thing. And I can tell you, the last 7 years, it's our inmates, it's the legislature, it's the governor, and it's not education. So I hope we can get it under control.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Yant. Any other additional comments? Seeing none, this concludes our agenda for today. I do want to let folks know that the next meeting of the House Education Committee will be on Friday, February 20th at 9 a.m. here in the Davis Committee Room. That meeting will be preceded by a meeting of the House Education Finance Subcommittee that will start at 8 a.m. The Senate Education Committee will not be meeting this Friday. Please note there is a joint task force on education funding on Monday, February 23rd, beginning at 3:30 p.m. in the Meltz Committee Room. That meeting will focus on special education. Additionally, just so folks have it in their queue, we will have our March 9th Joint Legislative Task Force on Education Funding meeting on major maintenance and school capital improvements. As there is no other business before us today, I will conclude this joint meeting of the House and Senate Education Committees at 9:39 a.m.